Okay. Over the last 10 years, we've been conducting diffraction-limited observations at the center of our galaxy from the Keck telescope, with the original objective of understanding the distribution of matter and the question of whether or not there's a supermassive black hole. I realize this is not an audience I have to convince, but I'll show you where our data set today is. And of course, it's opened up a number of new questions that this experiment has been able to address. There are a large number of people who've been involved in this project. In particular, I'd like to point out my two long-term collaborators, Eric Becklin and Mark Morris, who's here. My graduate students, Seth Hornstein and Jessica Liu, and Mark Rafelski, who have posters here. And then Milos and Nevin Warrenberg from Caltech, who are also at the meeting today. Okay, so what are the questions that we're trying to address? I won't show us all the details of the questions because Mark is actually going to address some of these tomorrow. But first, of course, is this question of whether or not there's a black hole. We'd like to know whether or not it's associated with that radio source, Sagittarius Star. We'd like to know why it's so dim, which Robin already brought up as a question. We'd also like to know from the orbit, not only whether or not there's a black hole, but once we can get both astrometric and radial velocity measurements, what the distance to the galactic center is or not. We want to see whether or not we can agree with Mark's compilation that we love to use, the 8.0 kiloparsecs. We'd also like to know whether or not we can detect deviations from the Keplerian orbits as a probe of what else is around the central black hole. We might expect, in fact, that there should be an entourage of stellar remnants. We know there are lots of massive stars. They're going to end their lives as black holes and neutron stars, and they may migrate inwards. So we may be able to detect that. We'd like to know when and where the stars are born. This is the topic of today's session. And we'd like to know whether or not the black hole influences the appearance and evolution of the stars. So this experiment that we've been done is basically capitalized on the advent of high-resolution imaging techniques on, in this case, the Keck telescope. In the next talk, you'll hear from on the VLT results. And this is just demonstrating what an improvement we've had. It's a factor of 20 improvement. These are our favorite IRIS-16 sources, the central one arc second with the Sagittarius star cluster. So, in fact, what I'll focus on for most of this talk are the stars inside the central box. And because I can't resist it, I have to do a little advertising. This experiment has been improved dramatically with the advent of the laser guide stars. You know, we got to keep up with our German friends. So, you know, last year we were having trouble computing because they have an infrared wavefront sensor, but we're back in business this year. This is the best natural guide star image we were able to achieve before. And this is the first one we were able to get this year under median seeing conditions. So it's about a factor of 2 improvement in Strel. Huge improvement in terms of the robustness of the observations. And of course, now we can mosaic. We're not just confined to the brightest star in the region. And Seth has a nice poster showing some of these results. So, the latest movie. You know you're going to see movies in both my talk and in Frank's, I'm sure. This is where the stars have gone in the central arc second over the last basically 10 years. It projects forward using the orbital solutions. The orbital solutions that we use are simultaneous fits to the orbits, assuming one common central point mass. So we fit to the common position and the common mass. We actually also allow for the black hole to move, so we can actually put constraints on the reflex motion of the black hole, as I'll explain in a minute. There are 3 particularly important stars, SO2 or S2, which has the 15-year period. This is actually one of the most important stars in terms of constraints on the mass and the distance and the extended mass distribution, simply because it's got the best coverage. The next most important star in this business is SO16, and I forget, is it S12 that you guys call it? Oh, anyway, S14. And it makes a complete U-turn. This guy gets closest to the black hole. It gets within 45 AU of the central black hole, moving at 12,000 kilometers per second. And then the other one that offers incredibly strong constraints is SO19, which makes its closest approach roughly in 1995. And then you see heading up here. In this animation, you can also see that we're already hitting the confusion limit. This is something you have to pay a tremendous amount of attention to if you are doing astrometry, because you don't want to use biased measurements. Okay, so the orbits, you can play the game individually for these three stars as well as for a guy named SO20 down here, and you get the same mass. And since we brought it in so close to the black hole, we're within 600 short shield radii, I think most people today are convinced that there is indeed a supermassive black hole. The individual orbits are not the strongest way. As I said, you want to do this simultaneously. So our current estimate is 3.7 million, assuming a distance of 8 kiloparsecs. So this is from astrometry alone. I'll talk about the radial velocities in a minute. The position we know to 1 milliarcsec, and it turns out that was important for studies of the infrared emission. Understanding exactly where you think the black hole is absolutely critical, given that stellar number density is so high. These stars are all moving in not straight lines, and there's modest intensity variations. And this is our limit on the velocity, which can put constraints on any intermediate mass black hole that might be floating around out there. Now, Mark Reed will also talk about a measurement of the motion of Sag J star. This is a slightly different measurement. This is a measurement with respect to the cluster as opposed to background stars. That's a subtle point, but it's one worth mentioning. The way we actually get this reflex motion, or you can conceptualize because it's from a simultaneous fit, is that the most important points in getting the position of the black hole occur at periaps. And because these three stars have periaps passages at different times, you're basically making three separate measurements of where the black hole is. And, well, at least with 2 points, you get a line, and 3 points, right? We believe it. So we get a limit of 30 kilometers per second. Okay. Well, astrometry is fine. We've been doing it for a number of years, but adaptive optics has allowed us to now get spectra. This is a spectrum of SO2, which has nice helium and hydrogen lines. And I'll get to in a second the characteristics of these lines. But for the moment, let's just think of it from the point of view of dynamics. This star has undergone, within a space of 2 years, a shift of about 3,000 kilometers per second. That's just simply because it went through Periaps Passage, closest approach, in 2002. This was our original measurement where, in fact, we didn't make a line detection simply because we didn't know what to look for. But now that we understand the characteristics of the line and we know the orbit, we can go back with a priori information and pull out the line. Why is this important? Well, it helps your orbits, no matter what you're trying to do, a simple mass. But you can actually go a step further and get a direct measure of the distance to the galactic center. Our current number is 8.6 plus or minus 0.3 kiloparsecs, as you'll hear from Frank in a second. They're getting a slightly smaller number. The nice thing is, while we don't quite agree, we all agree with Mark. Okay. And it basically boils down to our radial velocities, the fact that we are systematically measuring larger radial velocities than the German group. So I think that's something that we need to pay attention to in the upcoming years to really nail down what R-naught is. All right, so orbits, we can go a step further, both with the astrometry and the radial velocities. We can ask, well, how non-Keplerian could these orbits be? There's no reason right now to think that they aren't Keplerian, because the Keplerian model fits extremely well. In fact, these limits right now come from modeling SO2, 16, and 19 all together. But as I said, the strongest constraint is SO2 alone. You get maybe a factor of two improvement by adding the other two stars. And the way we do this is we assume that there is indeed a central point mass, and that surrounding that central point mass is an extended mass distribution that we model with a density profile with some density as r to the minus gamma. So in fact, we allow gamma and the density at 0.01 parsecs to be free parameters. The reason that we pick 0.01 parsecs is simply because SO2 goes from its closest approach at about 100 AU to its furthest approach at basically 2000 AU, which is 0.01 parsecs. Okay, so the important thing is a comparison of what's happening at closest approach to what's happening at furthest approach. So basically, you're really only probing the mass distribution over that range of separations, and you really can't say what's happening inside or outside those radii from this modeling. Okay, so what's the number? This is a little hard to read. This is the extended mass distribution that's outside the black hole, but within 0.01 parsecs. So that's the mass as a function of the power law that you've assumed for your density profile. So it's an arbitrary number. And at the one sigma level, we basically say that the one sigma level is 2 times 10 to the fifth solar masses, which is basically 5% of the black hole mass out to 0.01 parsecs. Is this interesting yet? Probably not profoundly yet, but this is an experiment like a fine wine that improves with time. It's only going to get better. And I think what's particularly important about this experiment is to constrain the possibility of stellar remnants in the context of migration models. We're going to talk a lot, hopefully today and tomorrow, about how efficiently stars can migrate inwards. So you really would like to know against what is it migrating. We can make some estimate from the luminous matter distribution, but we'd like to ensure that we really understand what we don't see that these stars could migrate against. Okay, so I'd like to turn our attention now to what kinds of stars are orbiting the black hole. We've been treating these stars like test particles, but what we'd like to know now is, what are they? And as we've already heard, and what most of us are familiar with, is that the majority of stars that have orbits are in this central region, whereas the German group has shown has a cusp. Majority of stars here are OB stars. In fact, they're really SO2, which is the brightest of them all, is an O9 stars, and the rest of them are consistent with B stars, as you'll hear from Frank's talk in a minute. Again, here's the spectrum that shows the nice helium absorption line, the bracket gamma absorption line. The equivalent widths really do look like standard OB stars, and they have rotational velocities that are not particularly high for OB stars. They're really typical, and their luminosities match their spectral types. Okay, so they're not particularly under or over luminous if we think we understand the extinction to the galactic center. Okay, so there's the paradox of youth. What are these stars doing there? They have no right to be there, as we've heard already from Robin. To get star formation, you need stars to the gas cloud to collapse. And the gas densities, which is why everyone wants to know what the gas densities are, need to be really high in order for this to happen in such close proximity to the black hole. If we just take SO2, or the Sagittarius star cluster stars, which really don't get any further than 0.01 parsecs, at that radius, one needs densities of 10 to the 14th particles per cubic centimeter. Nowhere near what Robin was telling us is there. I mean, so this is not a small problem, this is a huge problem. Okay, and I love this problem. It amplifies problems that were already raised by the helium emission line stars, which are further out. These are these bright IRIS 16 sources here. These are the well-known helium emission line stars. These are an order of magnitude and radius further out, which means the tidal forces are actually a thousand times greater in here. So this was recognized a long time ago. In fact, in the early 80s, it was argued the existence of these young stars meant we shouldn't believe in a black hole because you couldn't get star formation in the center of the galaxy. So now we really have a problem, given that we do really believe in the black hole. I'd like to point out, and hopefully we'll hear more about the kinematics of the helium emission line stars, but I thought I'd just throw it in here. The kinematics of these two populations of stars, the helium emission line stars, which are an order of magnitude further out, look different than the OB stars. So again, hopefully we'll hear more about these helium emission line stars, but I just want to mention that they have kinematics that look like they fall in two planes, whereas the OB stars look isotropically distributed. So I think we have to keep that in mind as we talk about formation mechanisms. Okay, the formation mechanisms. We'll spend a lot of time talking about this afternoon, but I thought I'd throw up one slide to give an overview of what are possible ways out. There are basically three ways out. One is that these are old stars masquerading as youth, and as I like to say in Los Angeles, we understand the phenomena extremely well, and there are lots of forms of astronomical Botox, so we basically just need to heat the outside of the star. And there have been lots of nice ideas thrown out, and again, I hope we hear about many of these today and tomorrow. One way is to make the outside of the star look hotter than it is if it were in an isolated environment. So Tal and Mark Morris made this nice suggestion of, I think they call them squeezars, these stars as they pass close to the black hole after having formed could be tidally heated. The problem, of course, is that you need to be extremely close. An idea originally suggested in the context of the helium emission line stars and then modified recently for the OB stars and the Sagittarius star clusters that these are stripped giants, either stripped by nearby passages or the central black hole. The problem here is is luminosity, that these things will basically cool off very quickly, so they really don't look like typical OB stars, at least not for very long, less than, I think it's 10 to the fourth year. So this is, again, a sort of unlikely scenario. Another idea is that these things could be sort of equivalent of blue stragglers, so merger products. And here the problem is the efficiency with which mergers will take place. Where the helium emission line stars, the stellar densities simply aren't high enough. In where the OB stars, the velocity dispersion is so high, again, that drops the efficiency. And then one has to question, and maybe somebody else will be telling us more about this, about what happens when these mergers occur. Do the merger products survive? Another class of solutions is that these stars are indeed young and did form in situ, so where we see them orbiting today. This means that we really need to invoke scenarios in which the past gas densities are much higher than we see them today. In particular, this is particularly problematic for the OB stars within 0.01 parsecs, where you need a factor of 10 to the 10th more than we see today. So you can do this by invoking accretion disks, which in the case of the helium emission line stars, you would have to invoke two of them. You'd have to get away to make the central stars look isotropic, because in fact these two scenarios would leave some remnant net angular momentum. So the second idea being that there would be some colliding gas clouds. Which folks in star formation have talked a lot about. And in this scenario, you expect the stars to form at the interface and to have one resultant angular momentum vector. So you'd actually need two collisions to give you two planes. And then again, you have to explain the central OB stars. The third class of solutions is that these are young, but they didn't have to form in situ, so to remove the tidal force, the tidal problem. So you form them at larger radii, where the densities can indeed overcome the tidal forces. But this means to get far enough away, where you have sufficiently high densities, you need to migrate in efficiently. So this is a question of what mechanism can make make that migration efficient. Given our current assumptions about what's there, the infalling cluster models basically gets us to the point where we have to start talking about intermediate mass black holes. And again, we'll hear more about this today. So there's a whole slew of resolutions to this paradox. But I just thought I'd throw in one new result that our group has. This is a result from Jessica Liu. She's a poster up today. And this is from looking at the velocity dispersion of the field, our larger field, and the discovery of a velocity dispersion minima near the IR-16 southwest star. In fact, this minimum is caused by five stars, one of which is IR-16 southwest, so we call this the IR-16 southwest co-moving group. This is the image that shows these five stars. These are part of the one of the planes. And in fact, if you take the model for that plane, that shows that these stars are in fact at the line of nodes. And if you a disk of stars, the line of nodes is actually a location which in projection should show you a velocity dispersion maxima. So this is actually fairly significant that this is a minima. So the interpretation here is that perhaps this is the remnant core, the remnant of an infalling cluster that's currently being tidally disrupted, and the phase mixing of the tidal disruption is what causes the plane. In fact, the other plane has the IRS-13 cluster that was originally pointed out by Maillard. Yes. So this is a Sagittarius star, north up, east left. These are our favorite 16 sources, and this is 16 southwest cluster here. So the axis, the plane goes like this. Oh, right, so I didn't have that quite right. Okay, as a last point, in 1 minute, we can ask, what can we learn about the accretion flow? Mark is gonna talk a lot more about this, what we've learned over the past few years, that we can detect it in the infrared, and this is thanks to our precise position of Sagittarius star. I think everyone's seen some version of this movie, so I'm not gonna dwell on it. But the things I do wanna point out, and that again, you'll hear more from Mark, and you should also see Seth Hornstein's poster that talks about the variability of Sagittarius star, and Shelley Wright, who talks about the extinction to the galactic center. We have these new laser guide star measurements, which lets us switch filters very quickly. So we have measurements within less than a minute at K, 2.2 microns, and L, 3.8 microns. And from that, we get a spectral index of 0.3. And this differs by quite a lot by, from recent reports of minus 3 as opposed to 0.3. And this is actually quite difficult to resolve. So I thought I'd point this out. There are basically three ways out that I can think of. One is that the flares are, as they get stronger, because in fact this was taken during a much stronger flare than these measurements were, they get bluer as they're stronger. The problem with this model is that if you look at the mid-infrared limits that you'll hear from Mark about tomorrow, using this slope, you should actually make a detection in the mid-infrared, and you don't. This slope actually gets you right under the mid-infrared limits. Another way out is that perhaps there's a break in the power law. The interesting thing here is that you don't have a lot of wavelength room to be changing significantly your power law. And then, of course, there's always the maybe we got it wrong, one of us, or more likely both of us. Okay, so there's work to be done there. But this is just a cautionary note for the theorists. Before we get too carried away, I think we really need to understand what's going on in the infrared. Okay, so in conclusion, got just 20 minutes, is we have strong proof of the central black hole. Don't need to convince you all of that. I think it's exciting that we have a direct measurement of R0. I think within the next 5 years, we can anticipate seeing R0 measurements made to about 1% accuracy. This will beat SIM. Sorry to say, Andy, I hope. And we have limits for the extended mass distribution. And again, this will only get better with time. There's been this paradox of youth raised and the detection of the infrared emission. What's for the future? Well, more orbits. You just have to wait. In fact, you just have to wait for these things to start curving. And of course, this improves as T cubed, so it's worth continuing. And we hope to detect deviations from Keplerian orbits. Oh, and just to advertise Nevin Weinberg's poster, we have hopes for 30-meter telescope because this minimum period should be a mere 1 year as opposed to a decade. And life gets exciting when you can get that close, because now then we can get out of the classical regime and start measuring relativistic effects. Thanks for your attention. This is just eye candy of 3D animation. Yeah. Within less than a minute. Oh, so that, or you can invoke radical changes on timescales of less than a minute, which we don't see in the light curve at other times. From this experiment, none, but you might be able to, mostly because in this region we get confusion limited at about 10 solar masses in the central arc second. You can learn a lot more at larger radii, which I think the German group has done a lot more work than we have. Yes, in the sense that their K-band spectra and their luminosity really behave. So I think the challenge now for us is to go look and to poke at these stars in other bands. So, yeah.
We never had one from this quarter. So,
Andrea, you said that movie stuff is really really hard to come.
Right, there are a couple of different effects that will affect the orbits in different way, the orbits in different ways. And usually what will happen is you can look at some vector, like either the inclination angle vector or the direction of apoapse, and those will start to form a line. So unless you invoke, so in fact it's predictable in which, if you only invoke one mechanism, interactions could randomize them. And the real question, which is why I think the deviations from Keplerian orbits is so important, is what's the stellar remnant population? Because I think right now, if you just take the luminous population, and you know assume the mass to light ratio that we know and love, there should be no significant randomization for most of these stars, given the age of OB stars. But if there's a big population under there, then that could, that the answer could be quite different.
Yuri, didn't you do that calculation at some point?
Right. This is why this understanding with the stellar remnant population is so important. The fact that they're not rotating quickly. In fact, the people who observe OB stars would say these are not particularly rapid rotators. Yeah, well, I think the strip giant thing gets ruled out more quickly by the luminosity argument. And in fact, you might actually use the rotation to say that the collisions isn't a likely scenario, because collisions would actually, I think, would make them rotate more rapidly than the typical population of OB stars.
We have several people wanting to answer that question.
This is just what the black hole would see for these stars. This is the intensity is actually changing as the stars come and go. This is the direction of SO2's apoapsis.
Simon, you have a question.
So, my one question are the O stars and the E stars both populated?
They are significantly overpopulated, but I think actually, Frank, are you going to show this plot? Or there is? Okay, I think they have some nice plots that they'll show you. But the answer is yes, they are overpopulated, and he'll show you a nice plot.
Erling?
Yes, and that was my comment that, so you'll hear from that Mark Reed about that, but the thing to remember is that the measurements are slightly different. The radio measurements are made with respect to background quasars, so in an absolute sense. And this proper motion experiment, the reference frame is done with respect to the central cluster. So, like I say, it's a subtle point, but they are slightly different types of measurements.
Do we have any last questions?
If we had higher spectral resolution spectra, which hopefully one day we'll... it's how we get our 170 kilometers per second for a rotational rate. So if you want to ascribe that to some other process. So we get 100, just for ascribing the line width to a pure rotation. Yeah, that's what we've done. We're not seeing any P Cygni profile, so that's why we didn't assign it to mass loss. These are relatively modest spectral resolutions, only R of 2,000. It is possible to make measurements of maybe R of 25,000 given our new setup, which maybe we'll do. Yes, we use the Manetti extinction law that was done based on, I think, the ISO measurements towards the galactic center. It depends on exactly where you are, right? It has and in fact, it's a good question because the 3.8 point is actually intermediate between a change of slopes, right at the edge. There's a nice, like I said, from Shelley Wright, who's a grad student, has some nice extinction. So our number is 31, by the way, AV. we're coming back up in terms of the numbers.
So we should move on. So let's thank Andrea and move on to Frank Eisenhower.